dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, Free Radio Olympia 91.3, or soon to be back on the air again, we hope, KFAR Knoxville 90.9, which was the only station in Knoxville, Tennessee operating in the public interest. Find out more about Knoxville First Amendment Radio at kfar.org. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The official story of the events of 9/11 are that Americans were the victims of a surprise attack, and in response, the government launched a war on terrorism that involved invading Afghanistan and Iraq in the name of national security. Then a so-called investigatory commission subsequently laid the blame for the attacks on intelligence failures. Last week on the program, we reported evidence that the Bush-Cheney administration lied about having foreknowledge of the 9/11 attacks and quashed lower-level law enforcement agents in the field who uncovered the plot, that the Defense Department under Donald Rumsfeld changed the decades-old standard procedure of air defense just 3 months before the attack to require approval by his office before launching planes to intercept a hijacked airliner, and that the Defense Department also simultaneously scheduled several concurrent military training exercises on September 11, 2001, some operating out of the White House, which diverted Air Force planes usually stationed in the Northeast to Alaska and Canada, and left the remaining skeleton crew paralyzed with confusion due to the presence on radar screens of at least 11 simulated hijackings, which were part of a training exercise dealing with terrorist hijacking of airliners. The very eventuality that National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice publicly stated could not have been foreseen. In other words, that the hijackings of 9/11 were known about and facilitated at the highest levels of the administration, and that the motive was to create an incident that would put public support behind an endless war whose goal is to control access to the Middle East, the site of the last of the planet's easily accessible and profitable oil fields. Thus, these wars were not the response to the attack, as we are supposed to believe, but the goal of the attack, a goal articulated in 1997 by a neocon think tank called the Project for a New American Century, which stated that an event on the order of a new Pearl Harbor would be necessary to mobilize public support behind this American Reich. Signers of this policy document included key figures in the present administration, including Vice President Richard Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, Vice President Cheney's Chief of Staff, Louis Libby, Richard Armitage, Deputy Secretary of State, Robert Zoellick, U.S. Trade Representative, as well as, among others, Jeb Bush, brother of George W. Bush. We also reported that these facts have been uncovered by dozens of citizen investigators and bereaved family members from the 9/11 Truth Movement, which is in the final phase of its project to prepare documentation of probable cause to demand that the Attorney General of New York State convene a grand jury to seek indictments against Vice President Richard Cheney and others in the administration for the murder of almost 3,000 people in New York City on September 11, 2001. And we also previously reported on the results of a recent poll that revealed that about half the people in New York State believe that some members of the administration had foreknowledge of the attacks and deliberately failed to stop them. We're going to delve further into the motive for such a fiendish betrayal of the people to examine the end justifying the means in the minds of the perpetrators, the phenomenon of Hubbard's Peak and the impending oil shortage. Then, an historical presentation covering 150 years of American wars that started with a pretext incident designed to overcome public opposition to a war that the leaders desired, usually for economic reasons. Ithaca resident Michael Dolner has extensively researched the phenomenon of peak oil. He gave a PowerPoint presentation to a meeting of the Trumansburg Back to Democracy Group on September 13th. What follows is the audio of that presentation.
This topic, probably many of you have heard of it before. It's called peak oil. It's sometimes called Hubbert's peak of oil. Many people ask, when will the oil run out? But what Hubbert was pointing out back in the 50s was that it's not so important when the oil runs out, which it never will, but when the oil will actually peak, when our production of oil will reach an absolute maximum because of primarily geological considerations, and thereafter will decline. And so the approach I want to take about it is, first of all, to talk about what is it, and then see when it's likely to occur. And I'm going to present a couple of different points of view and hopefully give you enough evidence so that you can decide for yourselves which one of them is right. And so let me just sort of start out with this. Basically what it is the claim that when half of the resource is gone, this is true of every particular oil field, when half of the resource is gone, then you can't pump it as fast. Oil is, it's not as if oil is sort of like a glass of water that you can keep drinking at a constant rate until it's all gone. Once you've taken half of it, then it becomes harder and harder to get the rest. And so Hubbert predicted the U.S. lower 48 state peak, and he actually predicted that it would happen in 1956, and he predicted that it would happen in 1971, and indeed it did. And let's see what the facts are here. I've taken these facts from BP, that's British Petroleum. They publish every year a set of facts. Since they're a British company, they measured in tons, which are slightly more than 2,000 pounds. It says that in 2002, we used 9,405 million tons of oil equivalent. That is, a ton of oil has a certain amount of energy. A ton of coal has a certain amount of energy. What they've done is figured out how much energy we used and measure that in terms of oil equivalent, right? And then they broke that down and say that's 27.65 billion barrels of oil, and you can see that what that is in tons. And these other numbers for natural gas, coal, and then, of course, there were other things too. Okay, this is basically how it breaks down. As you can see, 87% of the energy that's used is from non-renewable resources, oil, gas, and coal. And so then the question is, well, how much is there? Because we know that when we've used up half of it, it's going to start declining. So oil is 38% of all energy, but 90% of transportation. So it's not only a question of how much energy is there, but the fact that something like electricity is not very useful for powering cars and especially trucks and heavy equipment. You just can't really run that stuff on electricity. ASPO is the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. This is, if any of you have heard of this topic before, this is an organization developed by Colin Campbell and Jean Leharer. They're the people who say that this peak is going to be imminent, and they control a database which everybody, both their supporters and detractors, agree is the best in the world. So their facts as to how much oil is being produced are accepted by everybody, right? And so what they say is that the total amount of oil that we now know of is 1,850 billion barrels of conventional oil. Now, they've divided the oil up into conventional oil and unconventional. It really means cheap oil and expensive oil. Unconventional oil is hard to get. It's in the North Pole, it's under the ocean, it's oil shale, which is very difficult to extract the oil from, so on. OK, Conventional oil is the kind that we think of. You drill a hole in the ground and out it comes. It's fairly cheap to get. Okay, so we've used that much conventional oil, which, as you see, is almost half of it, right? There's still quite a bit of unconventional oil, but we've used about half of the conventional oil, which means that pretty soon that amount, that kind of oil is going to start declining. Unconventional oil is much more expensive, not only in money, but it's what they call energy return on investment. Right? They ask, well, how much energy does it take to get this unconventional oil out of the ground? And at a certain point, you take more energy to get it out of the ground than you're using. And so no matter how much money you are willing to spend, you're not going to be able to use that oil. So even though it's there, it's not particularly usable. Okay, so the Association for the Study of Peak Oil predicts that we will reach our peak next year, basically. That we will reach the peak of conventional oil next year. The former CEO I think it was Standard Oil, said we're going to need, by 2010, we'll need 50 million barrels per day that we don't have now. Right, or 18.25 billion barrels a year, more than what we use now. So that if we peak in 2005, obviously we're going to have an enormous shortfall by 2010. This little graphic here shows the cars produced in China. As you can see, in the last 5 years, it's grown enormously. Chinese imports increased by 25% last year. Right. Now, the question is, well, maybe Campbell and the Association for the Study of Peak Oil are wrong. And the reason they would be wrong is that more oil will be discovered and we'll be able to get more out of the ground than we can now. So this is the question. This is a little graph that they put out. That very nice bell curve is really just completely theoretical. The little red line where it's solid is the actual production. And if you can see, they have a peak there. This is a little bit old. Their peak there is 2010. Since the Iraq War and better measurements, that date has been actually getting shorter. So that, as I said, it's now 2005. The green lines are discovery of new oil. Campbell takes this into account as well. And as you can see, there were some very nice peaks in the 30s and 50s and a whole lot in the 60s. And now that's starting to decline too. So we're not finding as much oil as we used to. Okay, now opposed to Campbell and La Herrera are the United States Geological Survey. And they put out a Survey 2000 in which they say that the peak is really quite far in the future. Right? They're saying 2050. Right? So the question is, all right, so both of these people agree on the data, the amount of oil we've discovered, how much we've used. The difference is what we're going to discover in the future and whether we can increase the amount of oil we can get out of each well. Right? And so for us to work, you know, whether we're going to worry about this or not, the question is, how are we going to decide between these two basically scientific studies? This is a graph put out by ASPO, Campbell and La Herrera. And what their method is they go country by country. They record how much has been produced each year, how much has been discovered each year, what the decline in production is, what the trend in discovery is, and just from this point they project it on. So that, as you can see, their little peak there is somewhere around 2005, and then starts declining. And there are different kinds of oil here, and since I don't have all of that much time, I don't go into the important aspects of each of these little lines, but this is their method of deciding when the peak is, right? Take what's done in each country, add it up to see what the production is, what's the production trend, and project that on. Do the same thing for discovery, see what that is. that this is modified to some extent by the fact that these are both geologists. Both have worked for big oil companies, Standard Oil, Total, Elf, all of the major oil companies Campbell and Leherrer have at one time or another worked for. And so they know where and whether there are likely new discoveries in each country. Every month they put out a new newsletter and they examine each a country one by one, and they've gotten about 45 major countries done so far. Okay, the U.S. Geological Survey, okay, I've already gone through this. Here are some examples of data that they've collected. These are North Sea wells. As you can see, North Sea, these are the major fields in the North Sea. As you can see, they've most of them have peaked before 1990, and they're declining now. Now, there are a lot of smaller little fields that have made up for this, but at this point, the North Sea, which was the major oil find since 1970, is in terminal decline of about 6% a year, so that Great Britain, which has not only supplied itself with oil since the North Sea came online, but has actually exported oil, will have to start importing oil in 2007. And that may be a good motive for why they joined us in this Iraq war. Okay, now, there are certain limits to what they can do. The data quality is, for many places in the world, not great, and especially in the Persian Gulf, which is the central oil-producing area in the world. They have been very reticent to give out information. And so both Campbell and Leherrer know that their data there is limited. However, we can know quite well what they've produced. And there's a lot of many papers that have been come out to show that what their problems are, how it's becoming more and more difficult for Saudi Arabia, for example, to produce oil. What they have to do is pump an enormous amount of water into their oil wells in order to keep the pressure up to get the oil out. And this is now 35% of what comes out of the oil wells in Saudi Arabia is salt water that they put in before to get the oil out. So, and this is rising steadily. It's 35% now. It's going to be 50% within a few years. Here's another thing that's happened is that the Persian Gulf companies, when OPEC was formed, decided that the amount you're allowed to pump depended on your reserves. So everybody in the late 80s increased their reserves. And the little things that I've circled there show enormous jumps in reserves. For example, Abu Dhabi increased their reserves from 31 billion barrels to 92 billion barrels between 1987 and 1988. Even though there was no new discoveries or anything, they just did that. So we don't know how much they have. In all likelihood, they have a lot less than what they're telling us. This is the area also that where all the oil has been found. Many people will tell you that there's a whole large portion of Iraq to the west that hasn't been explored. Well, the reason it hasn't been explored is because, as you can see, all the oil wells, I don't know if you can see that, but they're in that red area. Are all in the eastern part of Iraq and the western part of Iran. There's been preliminary exploration done in the west, and nobody's ever discovered anything. So you'll often see encouraging things, people saying, well, there's a whole lot of Iraq that we can still explore and there's going to be oil there. Well, just because someone drew the boundaries in a certain place and called this Iraq doesn't mean that everywhere in that country there's oil. Okay, the USGS, right? U.S. Geological Survey, these are scientists also, and they can't be just eliminated offhand. What they do is a probabilistic approach. They study the rock formations, and they say, this kind of rock formation has there's a 5% probability of this much oil, a 95% probability of this much oil, and they figure, well, it probably has somewhere in between. And so the most notorious example of this was that in Greenland, they said, well, there's a 95% probability, and this is not on Greenland, but offshore in Greenland, They said there's a 95% probability of one barrel and a 5% probability of 112 barrels, so we'll count that as 47 billion barrels. Well, that's as much oil as the North Sea had in it when it started. So they're saying that Greenland is going to be as big, and counting it as big as the North Sea, which is the biggest discovery since 1970. So we can certainly question that. And no oil company has bothered to look for this. This right here is the key to my decision that Campbell and Laharer are right, and the USGS is wrong. The little orange dots tell us the actual exploration discovery. Smoothed out, what it is a five-year average. Each dot is a five-year average, so you don't get those peaks and troughs. And so you see that discoveries peaked in the 60s and have been more or less declining ever since. Where these lines branch off is where the different projections occur. P95, that agrees very closely with Campbell's and Laharer's projection. That says there's 95% probability of that much oil. The green one says that's P50, the mean, and that's where the USGS is claiming that we're going to make those discoveries in the next 20 years. The light blue line is the P5. Some people will even claim that that's the amount of oil that we're going to discover. Well, as you can see, the trend is, and this is all started in 1995. All right. Well, since then, we've discovered, in fact, less than the yellow line. We're nowhere near the green line. All right. So the USGS has made predictions starting in 1995. Their predictions require us to find about 21 billion barrels of oil a year, and we found about 7 or 8. Campbell and Laharer have said that they don't say we're not going to discover any oil. They say we're going to discover about 150 billion barrels, or roughly about 6 billion barrels a year. Now, they are a little bit under, but what they argue is that you're going to discover more first and less as the period goes on. So it's because of the experience, the evidence here, that I'm fairly convinced that the pessimistic projection is right. And the USGS, in spite of their being good scientists and seeming to have a good argument, and it's the argument that's going to be presented to you by people at Cornell, for example, are wrong. And so I'm saying here that, you know, basically what I'm saying is that we are facing peak oil, perhaps in 2005. Now, that's conventional oil, so we'll have a little bit more time, maybe through 2007, 2008, when the unconventional polar deep water oil will still be used. That'll be more expensive, but it'll still be enough to supply this, you know, outrageous lifestyle that we're living in until then, at which point it'll start being declining. There won't be enough to go around, and we will be in a struggle with China and Europe for the remaining oil supplies. Okay, this is a quote I found here. It says there was the number of major new oil fields, 500 million plus barrels, fell to zero for the first time ever in 2003, despite increase in technological expertise, and also despite fairly extensive drilling, though not as much as you'd think. And the reason for that is there aren't many opportunities. Okay, now USGS is attributing some of that new oil to reserve growth, which means increased technological ability to get more oil out of each oil well. There's been no evidence for this. As you saw with the decline rates I've shown you with the North Sea, they have continued to decline in spite of technological developments. And in some cases, these have been catastrophic declines. These technological developments have been allowed people to reach the peak earlier, and then the decline is faster. There's no increase in exploration, no supergiant fields. That's 5 billion plus found since 1975, and most were found before 1950. Okay, so if peak oil is imminent, as I think it is, what does it mean? Well, of course, gasoline prices are going to go up, and they're going to go up rather suddenly and drastically, because until now, economically, oil has been become more and more abundant, and the price has, in real terms, generally fallen. So it made economic sense to pump it at top speed, as everybody is doing now. Saudi Arabia has all of their oil wells open. So does every other Persian Gulf country. But as soon as oil becomes scarce, and it's clear that it's going to become scarcer and scarcer in the future, it'll become economically rational to hoard that oil and sell it later when it's more valuable. So not only will it be geologically a peak, but economically, scarcity will be enhanced by those who own the oil tending to hoard it, as they haven't done before this. Obviously, outlying districts, which we now are developing, I'm sure our movie is going to show us this. That's probably the point of it. I haven't seen this movie yet, but houses that are far away from stores, work, are going to become less valuable because it's going to cost people a lot more money to get to them. And we're going to have a real estate price collapse in outlying areas. And that's going to affect all real estate because there are going to be foreclosures, problems with banks. Stock market always shows turmoil when there's energy. It's really, there's a direct correlation between recessions and oil prices. Modern agriculture, I don't know if people know this, uses enormous amounts of petroleum, both for fertilizer and to run all the heavy machinery. As everybody knows, there are very few family farms. Farms are run with heavy machinery. All of them run on gasoline, diesel. All of that goes up. About 80% of the cost of producing food is petroleum. So cost of food is going to go way up also. There are going to be three basic political structures that are already forming in the world. There's East Asia, which is going to be China, Japan, Korea, and a number of other smaller countries there. Europe, France, Germany, and Russia, and the rest of the European Union are gathering together, and the United States, Canada, and the remainder of the Western Hemisphere are going to be struggling essentially for the remaining oil. And how that struggle turns out, nobody knows. But the Iraq War was the first shot fired, basically claiming, this territory belongs to us. And we could see that France, Germany, and Russia opposed this, not only for that reason, but they had an immediate meeting in Moscow as soon as the war began to talk about their response. That would be a very formidable alliance against us, and it's not overt right now, but it's forming. China, especially, is very dependent on energy, is constantly looking for sources of oil. They have recently made a deal with Iran to provide Iran with sophisticated technology, especially missiles, though not atomic warheads, in return for an oil deal. So this is an additional result of that. So it's pretty pessimistic, I know. What can we do about it? Now, I don't know how much more time I have here. I wanted to quickly do the question. I have another part of this on hydrogen. Hydrogen is touted as the solution to this, and I want to try to convince you that it isn't.
All right? About 10 minutes.
Okay. Let me just give quick reasons why hydrogen is not the answer for this. The current cost of fuel cell engines is $1 million each. And there's a website that I go to that has a lot of references about this. If you type in DOTY in your web in Google, you'll come to this guy who is a scientist. He has his own scientific enterprise, but part of it is a lot of research that he's done on hydrogen, and he has all the references there as well. He's convinced that cars will never sell for less than $90,000. Fuel cells are very delicate. It's difficult enough to make them run in the laboratory, but to run in a car is almost impossible. They've never gotten one that lasted long enough to take a trip from Florida to Maine. It'll always break down. They're sensitive to pollution, they're sensitive to jiggling around, and they're very expensive. They make hydrogen out of gas or an enormous amount of electricity. It'll produce enormous amounts of greenhouse gases, roughly three times as much as what we're using now, which is bad enough. The main thing I would focus on is storage of hydrogen. If we're going to use hydrogen as a transportation fuel, obviously it has to be stored in a car. Well, there's three ways of storing it. You can put it in these, it's kind of a compound with a metal hydrides, compressed gas, or liquid. And there's that website. If anybody wants to give me an email address, I'll send them a lot of information about this. Hydrocarbon storage is about $3 to $4 per kilogram. In other words, your gas tank in your car costs about $150 or so. If you want to store hydrogen as a metal hydride, it'll cost about $16,000 per kilogram. And you need about 10 kilograms there. So that's an enormous amount, right? This way of storing it is essentially ruled out by cost. It's also extremely heavy, 20 times as heavy as what we have now as a diesel tank. So we eliminate that. Compressed gas, all right? We have three possibilities. Well, 120-gallon compressed air tank stores that much kilogram hydrogen, not very much. Costs $730 or $1,300 per kilogram to store. We need about 15 kilograms to make a reasonable gas tank or hydrogen tank. It's also 200 times larger. As you know, hydrogen is very light. It's the lightest element. So a kilogram of hydrogen, even in liquid form, is four times the size of a kilogram of gasoline. So your gas tank would be 200 times the size of what it is now. So if it's 10 cubic feet, it's going to be 2,000 cubic feet. You know, so this is ruled out as well. Well, the last possibility is, well, let's just skip this. We can turn it into a liquid. Now, this is more...
Skip this part, because the idea is that hydrogen isn't going to work.
Hydrogen isn't going to work. All right. I just wanted to give you an argument. When someone argues for hydrogen...
There are a lot of reasons why.
There are a lot of other reasons. Okay. So, now, wind and solar, this could be a good possibility. However, not enough is being done right now. We had a record installation in 2003 of that much. And in 2004, thanks to Bush, all of the incentives for installing wind were taken away. And we have less than 500 megawatts installed in 2004. Now, there were that many new homes built in 2003. So essentially all of the wind power that was installed in 2003, an all-time record amount, was used to power the new homes. None of it could be used to substitute for the oil that's going to disappear. There's the amount of wind and solar as compared to the remaining other forms of alternative energies. Okay, nuclear, I don't have to go through that. I think everybody knows what's wrong with nuclear. Now, the one hope is biodiesel. And this is a real hope. Biodiesel, first of all, can be produced efficiently all over the place. You don't need huge plants to make it. It can be made out of a lot of waste. And what remains at the end can still be used as fertilizer and can be recycled. We don't need a new infrastructure for biodiesel as we do for hydrogen. We don't need all of these new plants and new stations. There's people at the University of New Hampshire have this proposal for making a large biodiesel, I don't know what you would call it, basically a lake that would produce biodiesel out of oil-bearing algae. And it would be near the Salton Sea. You need salt water to grow the algae, and you need runoff from the Salton Sea for nutrients. The Salton Sea in California is this horribly polluted sea where all of the nutrients from farming are deposited. Well, we could take that and make that sea better, produce biodiesel. And these people at the University of New Hampshire think with a huge project, we could produce something that would be significant. It does have problems, needs sequestered CO2. The nutrients in the Salton Sea are not going to last forever. If we'd actually do this, it would last for a while, and then you'd need something else. And of course, if we continue the way we're going now, then we'll need more and more oil all of the time. So
you'd still get CO2 from burning it.
Right, but the CO2 would be coming from the atmosphere, so it wouldn't. Right, so if we used algae, it would be greenhouse gas neutral if we could get the CO2 out of the atmosphere to grow the algae. And that would work, and it would give us, the only thing we can hope for is a soft landing. We have to change the way we live, basically. We can't. This problem is going to become acute by 2010, maybe sooner. If Bush attacks Iran, I would, if you look at the map there, you'll see the Strait of Hormuz is very narrow. They could cut off oil delivery from the entire Persian Gulf, and we would be in that oil crisis tomorrow. So the best we can do is a soft landing. What can we do ourselves? Use alternative energies is about the only thing, and begin to simplify your lifestyle, an attempt to make a local economy is the only hope. I do not believe there's any hope for the American way of life to continue for very much longer.
You've been listening to Michael Doliner speaking last week on peak oil at a meeting of Trumansburg Back to Democracy, which is a grassroots organization dedicated to raising issues of importance to our community, our country, and our world. It meets every other week for dialogue, educational programs, and to plan common action. The next meeting will focus on education and will be held Monday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at the Friends Meeting House in Perry City on Route 227 just north of Route 228. They have a website, backtodemocracy.us, and that is spelled back-to-democracy.us. Also, another event related to energy will take place on September 22nd. The Finger Lakes Group of the Sierra Club's Increasing Energy Efficiency Series begins with a presentation on geothermal heating and cooling in Ithaca, the fundamentals and the economics. It will be given by Stuart Berg, a retired electric power engineer at NYSEG. The talk will focus on the fundamentals of how geothermal heating and cooling works and the economics of installing a geothermal unit in the Ithaca area. That will be Wednesday, September 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Old Jail, located at 125 East Court Street in downtown Ithaca. Contact John Kaminsky for more information at area code 607-257-5909. 257-5909. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, Free Radio Olympia 91.3, or we hope soon to be back, KFAR Knoxville 90.9.
John Spencer was a farmer. He grew the Minnesota wheat. He rode there with his daughter, high upon the thresher's seat. They broke down on the hillside, The radiator spitting steam. Went back to get the toolbox so they could fix the old machine. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we can fix the tractor. We can make it like new. But that day they got a letter that said the power lines would come right across their farmland, right across the setting sun. So they gathered all the family and talked late into the night. We cannot let them do this. We've got to put up one hell of a fight. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we'll apply a little pressure and we'll see what that will do. So they phoned 100 farmers and drove to the Twin Cities. Met there with the governor and they sued the utility. But after writing all the letters and paying all the legal costs to the power of the city, once again the farmers lost. And in the still of the evening, the wind is all you hear. I watch the waves on the wheat fields alone. I walk the furrows of earth I plant year after year. This is our land, this is our home. Our land, this is our home. So they met there at the tavern, but there wasn't much to say. The power lines may come, but they will not stay. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, once put together, we can easily undo. With bandanas on their faces, careful not to make a sound, they loosened all the bolts that held the towers to the ground. And several weeks later, with nobody around, Minnesota wind blew tower after tower after tower down. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, what was once put together.
For the remainder of the program, a presentation by Richard Sanders on the history of the war pretext stratagem. This talk was given at Phase 2 of the International Citizens' Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11, held last May in Toronto.
I really appreciate this opportunity to speak about one of my favorite pet peeves or pet topics. I'm going to be speaking about a specific type of pretext stratagem, the war pretext incident. Now, first of all, what's a pretext stratagem? Stratagem is from the Greek, and it means a device or act of a general. Stratos being the Greek word for army. And it means basically a trick or a scheme that's used to deceive an enemy in war. A pretext is, of course, a false reason or a motive that's put forward to hide the real motive, the real reason. In short, it's an excuse. It comes from the Latin pretextum, and the roots of the word are interesting because they've got the prefix, and which means before, and texer, which means to weave, to weave. So literally it means to weave before. So we're talking about the act of weaving a web so that we can place it in front of something else, something that we want to hide,
something that we want to disguise, to cover, to mask, in order to deceive others about what we're really doing and why we're doing it. And it brings to mind that great quote from Sir Walter Scott, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." So throughout history, war planners have been using many different forms of pretext stratagems as tricks to deceive their enemies. And because public support is so essential to starting a war, the home population becomes part of the enemy, at least as far as the war planners are concerned, because the home population actually has the power, potentially, to stop a war in midstream or to prevent a war from happening. If the public doesn't swallow the pretext, then they will not send their boys and girls off to war, and they will not invest billions of dollars from their taxes and treasury into a war. The war planners know this. They know that we have power. Otherwise, they wouldn't come up with these pretexts. They know that they need to con the public. That's proven by the very fact that they create these pretenses and justifications for war. It's an increasingly essential step in building public support for launching what would otherwise be totally unpalatable, unpopular wars. If the real reasons for wars were known to the public, the real economic reasons were known, people wouldn't go. They'd just say, no, I'm not going to be involved in that war, no. If the war planners, can you imagine this? We want to have a war, we want you to send thousands of people off to be killed, it may threaten our country, and we want you to do this because there's a few of us here that want to increase the billions of dollars that we have. We want to become even wealthier than we are already, and we want to become multi-billionaires. Join us in our war. No, we won't go. So bullies, I mean, war planners are, in a way, they're kind of like schoolyard bullies. There's a metaphorical link there. Both of them shout things like, he hit me first. And they know that it's irrelevant whether the other person did hit you first or not. You just have to be able to make it appear that this is what happened, that there was an unprovoked attack. Someone else threw the first punch. If you can prove to your audience that somebody else hit you first, then you are justified in hitting them back, in responding, in retaliating, when in fact, it's not a retaliation, it's not a response, because they never hit you, or you pretended that they hit you, or you hit yourself and scarred yourself and fell down and then said, hey, he hit me, whatever. There's many different ways that they have of these war pretext incidents come in many different shapes and sizes and colors and textures. Basically, they have the art of taunting, teasing, threatening, and provoking. Very finely honed, and they're very skillful at this. You goad the enemy into firing the first shot, and then you fabricate lies about what happened. And these things can be used to rationalize a schoolyard beating or a genocidal war. It's the same basic principle. And these pretext stratagems, war pretext incidents, have been used by every military power in history. They've probably been used for thousands of years. Although weapons have changed greatly over time, these forms of deceit have not changed that much. They've remained remarkably consistent. And my focus today is going to be on war pretext incidents that are used to deceive the home populations, to ignite popular support for going to war, and to demonize the enemy. War pretext incidents are powerful, dramatic events, and they almost seem theatrical. And that's because they often are theater. They're a kind of military street theater. Activists, I don't know how many sort of peace activist type of people we have here, but you may have been involved in things like, a die-in, a street theater thing where you pretend, you fall down and you pretend you've been killed and you're trying to dramatize something, the horrors of war. Well, military street theater sometimes involves the real loss of life, and real people are killed, and it's done to make a symbolic point. It's theater. And they're doing it to create media, they're doing it also to provoke media and get media response. And as a quick aside to respond to the desire from the from the person who introduced me for what do? I think one of the things we need to think about are how do we create our own kinds of pretext incidents. Now, a peace pretext incident or an anti-war pretext incident. And I'm thinking of things like Gandhi's Salt March or the lunch counter sit-ins. Our pretext incidents would be nonviolent and they would not be secretive. They would be open. So they're quite different, but in some ways they're the same. You would try to provoke a media attention, and you're trying to galvanize public support, and you're trying to show who the real enemy is. Okay, so throughout history, these attacks have been either deliberately incited or provoked, completely fabricated from whole cloth, detected in advance but allowed to occur, or engineered and then blamed on the desired enemy. In every case, the event is then widely exploited to arouse widespread public sympathy for the victims, to demonize the attackers, and to build widespread support for military retaliation. So it's not enough just to have a war pretext incident. That in itself is not enough. You need to do follow-up work. You need more psychological operations, psyops, to exploit the pretext after it's been done. The official version of events, they're constantly repeated, their dramatic narratives are spawned, and those are lodged into the public consciousness. They become accepted without question. The corporate media, of course, totally essential, central to the success of this kind of war propaganda. Politicians rally around the flag, demanding a military response, demands for retaliation ring out across the land, war hysteria builds and mounts, and finally a war can be born. Now, every time the United States has gone to war, pretext incidents have been used as triggers to justify military action. A lot of them eventually come out as fabrications or lies or provocations or deceptions. Eventually, these things get uncovered. And in the internet age, they're more quick to, it's easier and quicker for us to uncover the pretexts. In the old, good old days, they would have just found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They would have, here they are, you know. And they can't do that as easily now. There's a lot of, it's much more difficult for them to get away with that sort of thing. There's so much ability for us to research and expose the lies. I'm being optimistic. I'm hoping that's the case. Okay, the material in my talk today, I'm going to go through, I'm going to try to get through 7 examples. And I did this research for a magazine, our magazine Press for Conversion. It's for issue number 50. It's a quarterly magazine, and that issue 50 was called Going to War, the American Use of War Pretext Incidents. Okay, but keep in mind that history is always more complex than it seems. Everybody knows that. It's difficult to capture complicated historical events in a few minutes, and I'm going to try to do 7 examples in the next hour, 7 examples from 1846 to 1999 over the next hour. Here we go, 1846, the Mexican-American War. I'm going to give you a bit of the, in each case, I'm going to give you a little bit of the context and on the pretext incident, the follow-up, and a little bit on the real reasons for the war. Okay, after Mexico's 1821 revolution, some Americans demanded $3 million in compensation for their losses. Mexico abolished slavery in 1829. Then it tried to enforce its authority over their state. Texas was a state of Mexico at the time. But then the Texans drove the Mexican troops out, proclaimed independence. Then some Texans tried to lobby the United States to try to get Texas brought into the United States. But there were especially Northerners that didn't want to do that. They didn't want to risk a war with Mexico, and they didn't want to admit another slave state into the Union. In 1845, President John Tyler, Texas was annexed, and Mexico broke off diplomatic relations with the United States. A year later, Polk was the president, and he won by one of the thinnest, I think it was the thinnest margin that he won by of any president to that point. He sent an envoy to Mexico, and he offered $25 million to buy New Mexico and California, but the Mexican government refused to even meet his envoy. Now, for the pretext. So they obviously needed a war. They couldn't just go, and Mexico would not sell it to them. Okay, so John Stockwell. May know him as a former CIA guy who ran the covert 1970s war in Angola. Well, he comes from Texas, and here's how he summed up the pretext. They offered $2 a head to every soldier who would enlist. They didn't get enough takers, so they offered 100 acres to anyone who would be a veteran of that war. They still didn't get enough takers. So General Zachary Taylor was sent down to parade up and down the border, the disputed border, until Mexicans fired on him, and the nation rose up and we fought the war. So what happened was President Polk sent General Taylor and 3,500 soldiers down into Mexico to deliberately provoke an attack against U.S. troops. That was his purpose in sending them there. We know that on May 8, 1846, Polk told his cabinet at the White House that if the Mexicans attacked the American army, he would ask Congress to declare war. And that's exactly what happened. So 3 days later, they got word that that they had been supposedly attacked by the Mexicans, and Polk sent a message to Congress saying, quote, Mexico has passed the boundary of the United States and shed American blood on American soil. 2 days later, Congress declared war on Mexico. Senator John Calhoun said that when Polk's war bill was rammed through Congress, quote, we had not a particle of evidence that Mexico had made war against the United States. After a few days after taking his seat in the House, freshman Congressman Abraham Lincoln asked Polk in a somewhat famous speech called the Spot Resolutions, he asked Polk where the exact spot was where the, quote, the blood of our citizens was shed. Lincoln was exposing Polk as a corrupt liar who had fabricated the pretext for war, because Polk said it was they had shed American blood on American soil. But in fact, the reality is that it was that wasn't the case, as I just explained. So the follow-up that happened was that newspapers then helped to push for war, and they had lots of headlines like, quote, Mexicans killing our boys in Texas. U.S. forces then occupied New Mexico and California. Tens of thousands of Mexicans died, a lot of them because of artillery bombardments of residential areas, and 13,000 U.S. soldiers died in the war. The U.S. troops took over Mexico City and occupied most of, or a lot of, northern Mexico. And very quickly, a new U.S.-friendly Mexican government emerged. Can you spell regime change? In 1847, with American troops occupying Mexico City and northern Mexico, the new and improved Mexican leadership conceded defeat. So the real reasons for the war, pretty obvious, really. They'd been brewing for some time. A former president, John Adams, said, quote, the design and purpose to dismember Mexico has been a fixed fact since 1830. So the war boosted, not only it boosted American nationalism and popular support for a very weak president, but most importantly, it added over 1 million square miles of territory to the United States, a lot of that where slavery was now legal. So Mexico lost Texas, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, California, and parts of Colorado, Kansas, and Wyoming. Pretty lucrative war. Okay, 1898, the Spanish-American War. During the 1800s, the Cubans had been fighting against Spanish colonial rule for decades. The latter half of the 1800s, they fought, I think, four different main wars against Spanish control. And they were on the brink of winning their independence in 1898. On January 1898, on the pretext of protecting the life of the American consul in Havana and other U.S. citizens there, in the face of some street disturbances, riots or something that were happening, the battleship Maine, the American battleship Maine, which was like one of the most advanced battleships of the time, entered the Bay of Havana. Okay, now the pretext incident. February 15th, 1898, a huge explosion sank the USS Maine, and it killed 266 U.S. personnel that were on board. No one, still to this day, no one knows for sure what caused the explosion. The Spanish really had no motive to provoke a war because the Americans were vastly superior militarily, and there's no way they could win a battle with the United States. So in 1975, U.S. Admiral Rickover investigated, and he concluded that there was no evidence of an external explosion. It was an internal explosion that sank the Maine, and he said that it was probably caused by a coal dust explosion